He adjusted his gun, looked away.
Ima mo Harvate,
he called over his shoulder. Harvati, Croatians. Despite his drunkenness, he still managed a clear inflection of disgust. Another soldier approached and pressed his gun against the soft skin of my father's neck.
Everybody out,
he said then, turning to the rest of the men.
Get the others.
Mama, where are we? I don't know, Anna. Just be very quiet. Maybe they want to search us.
The car bobbed on its corroded shocks as we climbed from our seats. A line of cars had formed along the side of the road. Farther off, a group of civilian prisoners stood on a patch of browning grass, shifting their collective weight uneasily. I stared at them, tried to get someone to look back at me, but no one would. I was jolted from my gaze when a soldier jammed his gun into my back, sending a shock of pain up my spine.
Tata!
I called out to my father as the soldier wrapped a thick coil of barbed wire around my wrists. The soldier let out a laugh and a mouthful of air that stunk of alcohol. Tides of the soured milk pitched against the walls of my stomach.
Fuck you! Fuck all of you!
My father was yelling, struggling against his own wire cuffs. The soldier behind him struck the back of my father's knee with the barrel of his AK. My father's leg twisted in a way it shouldn't have, and blood ran down the back of his pant leg. He was quiet. I made my way over to him, leaned my head on his hip, and instinctively reached for his hand, but the wire around my wrists sunk into my flesh.
We're going to be fine,
he said, softly now.
Just don't get separated.
Beside him, my mother was shaking a little, even though she was wearing her coat. I'd left my jacket in the car, but somehow I didn't feel cold. The realization that my parents, too, felt pain and fear frightened me more than any strangers could. Panicked thoughts came like a rush of river water. They were going to take our car. We were going to be beaten. They were going to send us to the camps. They herded us into the group of other prisoners, a series of men wearing painters' jumpsuits and stolid expressions, a teenage couple trying to touch one another and recoiling when the wires caught their skin, a woman with a run of blood down her thigh, an old man with white stubble and scuffed black orthopedic shoes. Others.
Haide! Let's go!
Barked the leader of the soldiers. He staggered toward the forest that lined the road. I focused on not moving my wrists beneath the wire, watching my feet as they sunk into the underbrush with each step. The child of a concrete city, I had never been in a forest before. It was cold and dank-smelling, like the basement of our skyscraper. The viney brushwood seemed to grab at the tops of my sneakers. I thought of Sribor and his kingdom and wished for a glimpse of magic inside a hollowed oak, a miraculous escape route. As we walked farther into the forest, the afternoon sunlight was swallowed by shadows.
Tata,
I whispered.
Why is it so dark in here?
But the group had stopped, and he didn't answer. We'd reached a clearing, the forest floor packed so thoroughly under the heels of combat boots that there was no more plant life, only dirt and rotting acorns. In front of us were the remnants of an extinguished fire, and a large hole in the ground. Behind me, someone was shouting. One of the painters had tried to run back toward the road, but his gait was off balance with his arms tied behind him. A soldier caught him quickly, and after a smack of the rifle across the legs, the man was on his knees. The soldier pulled the man up by his hair, moving his head side to side at an unnatural tilt before letting him drop again to the ground. The man lay in the dirt, and the soldier wiped a clump of hair from his hand before angling the butt of his gun and dispensing a swift blow to the back of the head. Blood, runny, and a dent where bone used to be.
Anyone else?
The soldier said. His teeth were brown. The soldiers organized us into a single file line. They shoved and jabbed. If someone didn't move fast enough, they bludgeoned. They arched the line perfectly around the mouth of the pit. The first time, the noise that came out of the AK didn't sound like a gunshot. It sounded like a laugh. There was a unified gasp as the first victim crumpled and fell into the void below. For a few seconds, a minute even, nothing happened. Then another shot, and the man next to him, another one of the painters, went. Witnessing these men's deaths taught the rest of us two things. They were going to do this slowly, and they were going left to right. This was not the most efficient way to kill people, but it was not the least efficient either. It was good target practice for the new recruits. It was slow enough to make the prisoners squirm. It wasn't messy, bloody maybe, but once they fell, they were already half buried. My father looked down at me, then back to my mother on his left side. His mouth twisted as he pulled his eyes away from hers, then spoke to me in a sharp whisper.
Anna, Anna, listen to me.
A shot.
We're going to play a game, okay? We're going to trick the guards.
A shot.
They're drunk. It'll be easy if you pay attention. All you have to do is stay close to me, very close.
A shot.
Then, when I fall down into the hall, you fall at the same time. Just close your eyes and keep your body straight.
A shot.
But it won't work unless we both fall at the very same time, okay?
A shot.
Do you understand? Don't look at me.
I didn't understand what was happening, really, how we could trick the guards out of shooting us. But my father seemed sure that if we both fell at the same time, we would be okay, and he was always right.
Is Mama going to fall with us, too?
A shot.
No. She...
My father's voice cracked.
She's going to go first.
I looked at my mother. Watched my father watching her, the way something in his irises extinguished.
Anna.
My father's whisper was much harsher now, frantic.
Listen, once we fall, we have to stay absolutely still and wait until it's quiet above us. Then we'll get out together, okay? Just remember.
A shot. My mother swayed on the rim of the muddy cavity. A dot of crimson appeared at the curve of her lip, streamed down her chin. She seemed to hover there, as if she'd jumped on purpose, landing quietly, not with the thud of the others before her. I felt myself yell as I realized what had happened. Another shot, one that echoed. I waited, watched my father, then held my breath and fell. It was dark and sticky, and it smelled like sweat and piss. I turned my face to the side so I could breathe. Something heavy came down on my legs, but I felt far away from my body and couldn't move. I concentrated only on the corner of my once white t-shirt as it soaked up other people's blood. I used to think all languages were ciphers, that once you learned another's alphabet, you could convert foreign words back into your own, something recognizable. But the blood formed a pattern like a map to comprehension, and I understood the differences all at once. I understood how one family could end up in the ground and another could be allowed to continue on its way, that the distinction between Serbs and Croats was much vaster than ways of writing letters. I understood the bombings, the afternoons sitting on the floor of my flat with black fabric covering the windows, the nights spent in concrete rooms. I understood that my father was not getting up. So I waited. My head light and spinning and my eyelids heavy and came around to the stench of stale fear and the beginnings of decay.
Don't worry about it. We'll get the bulldozer in from Obrovac,
the leader of the soldiers said. Already the bodies around me were cooling, beginning to take on the putty-like feel of dead flesh. My heartbeat thundered in my ears, panic coursing up my neck. But the soldiers obeyed orders, and I listened as the footsteps disappeared and the echoes of the footsteps disappeared, stayed motionless until I convinced myself I had heard them starting up their jeeps.
Tata,
I said. I knew already, but inched closer against him anyway, nudged his shoulder with mine.
Wake up!
His eyes were clamped shut tight, as if he were counting for a round of hide-and-seek, but there was blood, at his neck, on his lips, in his ears.
Wake up!
It was impossible to take a deep breath,
I tried to move, but my legs were pinned down beneath the leg of the person who'd fallen next to me, a teenage boy missing the back of his head. The weight of his body made it worse. I was sure I was suffocating and kicked wildly, trying to shake him off. My hands were still bound, and I struggled to sit. Then, using the dead as step stools, I climbed out of the ground. I pulled my wrists out of the wire, squeezed one hand through violent and quick, then unwound the steel and freed the other. Strings of my skin clung to the barbs. Blood dripped in staircases down toward my fingertips. We hadn't been very deep in the forest, and I followed the boot prints out to the road. The soldiers had left the felled tree, but had taken the sandbags with them. They had set our cars on fire. I saw the charred skeleton of what I thought had been our car, pointing like a giant arrow, and decided to continue in the direction we'd been driving, homeward. It seemed important to keep walking, but my legs were stiff with shock, and the path ahead blurred in and out of focus. I moved with excruciating slowness. Night turned to dawn, though I didn't notice the change until it had already passed, as if I'd been a sleepwalker, awakened by the sunlight. The shadows were shrinking as I arrived on the outskirts of a village, in the glow of a new morning. Part 2. Somnambulist. Chapter 1. I woke in the cobalt part of dawn. It was too early to leave, but there was no chance I'd fall back to sleep now. Not wanting to wake Brian, I compelled myself to stillness for a minute or two, tried to match the rise and fall of my chest with his, but already consciousness had quickened my heartbeat, and I found it difficult to keep from fidgeting. I slipped from his bed, and he breathed a deep, surfacing kind of breath, but did not wake up. I returned to my dorm to change, tried to smooth the cowlick on the right that emerged with exceptional stubbornness whenever something important was scheduled. Outside, the cold burned my throat, but I continued on foot anyway, to kill the time. The roads were slushy, leftovers from a late-night snow plowing, slippery beneath my sneakers as I crossed the avenues and headed uptown. A few business owners were pushing up their grills to start the day, but overall the city was stark and quiet, as empty as Manhattan gets. For long stretches of my walk, I didn't cross paths with anyone. The lobby of the UN headquarters was not what I expected. Though I'd been attending college in New York for nearly 3 years, I'd managed to avoid the complex on the East River. Now, inside and waiting in a metal detector line, I felt an odd mix of anticipation and disappointment. Over the years, I'd lost faith in the UN. Their interventions in my country and across the globe were tepid at best. But I'd still assumed the compound would be impressive, decorated with vainglory. In parts, it was. The four-story ceilings made me feel small. The balconies of glass and concrete curved around the entrance hall in a slick, modernist wave, suggesting progressivism. In other ways, though, the interior was unremarkable. The checkered marble floor was covered in strips of stained industrial carpet. The surveillance cameras were so conspicuous I was sure they were fake, and that streamlined equipment was positioned at more clandestine angles. The woman who'd asked me here had called over Christmas break. I was easy enough to track down. I hadn't strayed from the people or places to which I was headed when we'd first met. She told me that after her stint in Yugo peacekeeping, she'd returned to New York and muscled her way through the bureaucracy to a liaison position. Now she was working on a new project, forming a committee to focus specifically on human rights. She told me she needed me. I told her I was at college in the city, and she said, "Remarkable," which offended me, though I knew she had a point. Then I said something cheerful, like, "Fridays are perfect. I won't even have to miss class." Something she was pleased with, and I regretted before I hung up the phone. I was early and took a seat on a bench to wait. I gazed at the men in suits, wondering if any of them had been in the decision room or on the ground during my war.
The woman, Ms. Stanfeld, had never been anything but kind, and I felt guilty about the derision running through me as I scanned the lobby for her face. Finally, I caught her in my peripheral vision, dressed in a suit and high heels, her hair straightened and pulled into a bun. The last time I saw her, she was in combat boots and a blue flak jacket, a tangle of wavy hair beneath her helmet. Her face was the same. It occurred to me that my appearance had likely undergone a more radical transformation. I'd grown about a foot and a half since then, so I stood and started in her direction. Before I even tried to get her attention, she called out to me.
Anna Jurich?
It was a last name I hadn't heard in a long time. Miss Stanfeld, I thrust my hand out prematurely, and it dangled. Please, call me Sharon. How did you recognize me? The eyes. For a moment, she looked unsure whether she should say more. And we don't see those shoes much around here. I snuck a peek down at the Converse high tops I'd pulled on in a last-minute fit of groggy defiance. I followed Sharon out of the main lobby and down a corridor. She excused herself to go to the bathroom, and I wandered the hall. I poked my head into open conference rooms trussed in heavy curtains and adorned with religious-looking paintings that, upon closer inspection, were devoid of any actual religion, eagles and haloed planet Earths in place of crucifixes. Farther down the hallway, I noticed a set of ornate wooden doors and a plaque declaring Chambers of the Security Council. I imagined the delegates of a decade ago convening on the other side of that wall, discussing the body count of my parents and friends, and determining that, yes, something would have to be done to keep up appearances, but that it would be best to stay out of such a messy conflict. I slipped my fingers around the handle and tugged gently, but the door was lighter than it looked and opened wide. A rush of air wind-tunneled into the room, and a few delegates in the back row turned to look at me. I felt a hand on my shoulder. It was enough to startle me into loosening my grip, and the door swung closed. Sharon was offering me a cup of coffee and a frosted croissant in wax paper. They'll be done in a few minutes, then a quick coffee break, and we're on. She tried to snap her fingers, but the wax paper got in the way. I followed her to a smaller room with fossilized adhesive on the wall where a plaque had been removed. She tracked my gaze. It's our room now, she said with pride. But I haven't had half a second to put in the application for new signage. Why don't we go get settled at one of the front tables? She handed me the cup and the pastry. Any of the reserved spots is fine. The room was windowless and paneled in dark wood, the tables and chairs arced in a semicircle. I chose a seat and took a swig of the coffee that turned out to be hot chocolate. I choked it down. I usually took my coffee black. The sweetness stuck in my mouth, and it dawned on me that, for Sharon, I would always be 10 years old. In America, I'd learned quickly what it was okay to talk about and what I should keep to myself. It's terrible what happened there, people would say when I let slip my home country and explained that it was the one next to Bosnia. They'd heard about Bosnia. The Olympics had been there in 84. In the beginning, adults operating somewhere between concern and nosiness had asked questions about the war, and I spoke truthfully about the things I'd seen. But my descriptions were often met with an uncomfortable shifting of eyes, as if they were waiting for me to take things back, to say that war or genocide was actually no big deal. They'd offer their condolences, as they'd been taught, then wade through a polite amount of time before presenting an excuse to end the conversation. Their musings about how and why people stayed in a country under such terrible conditions were what I hated most. I knew it was ignorance, not insight, that prompted these questions. They asked because they hadn't smelled the air raid smoke or the scent of singed flesh on their own balconies. They couldn't fathom that such a dangerous place could still harbor all the feelings of home. Soon I changed my approach, hand-picking anecdotes like the great ding-dong ditch affront on the Serbian man's flat, or the games we invented in the shelters, until I'd painted Zagreb with the light-hearted strokes of some carnival funhouse. The version of things they ended up with was non-threatening, even funny. But to create a palatable war was tiring and painful, so one day I stopped completely. I grew, and my accent faded. For years I didn't reveal anything at all. I passed as an American. It was easier that way. For them, I told myself. But the UN delegates, now making their way to their seats, knew who I'd been a decade ago. They would be thirsty for gore. I wasn't sure what to tell them. I'd stayed up late thinking of what to say, had tried to organize things into an outline, but all these years later, I still had no narrative to make sense of what had happened. Across the room, two teenage black boys shuffled into the front row and slumped low in their chairs. Africa, I thought. Lost boys, or RUF child soldiers. I wondered whether Sharon had recruited them too, or if they were someone else's project. Sharon stood and gave an introduction while the projector blinked a big red no signal on the screen. I watched an intern jiggle the connection wires. After a second reset, the slideshow appeared. Children in combat, in 3D word art auto-focusing overhead. "Presenting first is Ana Juric," Sharon said. "Ana is a survivor from the Yugoslavian Civil War." The slide exhibited before and after maps of Yugoslavia and its subsequent color-coded divisions. At age 10, she was also involved in rebel combat missions against Serb paramilitary forces. A quiet murmur floated across the tables at this. "I'll let her introduce herself more fully, though," Sharon said, which I took as my cue to stand. Unsure applause rippled through the room, and I walked to the spot where Sharon had been standing. The auditorium felt much bigger from the front. I pulled the folded index cards from my pocket, but the bullet points now seemed useless. I coughed, and it echoed across the chamber. A memory of my father resurfaced. I had been nervous about performing a solo part in my third-grade Christmas concert.
"Just sing loud," he had said. "If you're loud, everyone will believe you got it exactly right."
"I'm Ana," I said. "I am 20 and in my third year at NYU, studying literature." There was a time when I would have been afraid of this room, of the dignitaries and their stiff, suited language, but now I felt more weary than scared. I'd grown out of fear like my childhood clothes, and after the initial adrenaline subsided, my voice settled. "There's no such thing as a child soldier in Croatia," I declared as the next slide flashed, two teenage girls sporting camouflage and scuff-marked assault rifles. "There is only a child with a gun." It was a semantic argument, and bullshit at that, and just like in the lecture halls at university, they were eating it up. The girls in the picture were strangers, but they could have just as easily been me. Caught in that void between childhood and puberty, skin still smooth but limbs gawky from growth spurts. Each held a Kalashnikov across her chest. The taller girl had her other arm over the shorter one's shoulder. They might have been sisters. Both gave half smiles to the camera, as if they remembered from another time that one was supposed to smile in photographs. Who had taken these pictures, I wondered, as I continued on with the speech, recounting our journey home, my parents' murder, the village I'd gone to after. Certainly not the locals, who wouldn't find the image notable enough to warrant a photograph. Too early in the war for trauma tourists, who appeared only after the danger was gone. Must have been journalists, a breed of people I still couldn't understand. Outsiders who claimed the moral high ground, then stood back and snapped photos during encounters with bloodied children. "Combat was not an option," I said. "It was just a thing we did to live, a part of home." The slides made the girls look foreign, animals captured on safari, but we were far less exotic than that. When I thought of my own weapon, I remembered not its existential power, but its weight, heavy against my slight frame. the way its strap rubbed a raw spot on my shoulder, the almost ticklish sensation of my stomach absorbing the pulsating mechanical rhythm as I shot from the hip. We were not like the children of Sierra Leone, who, a continent away, were fighting their own battles that same year. We weren't kidnapped and spoon-fed narcotics until we were numbed enough to kill, though now that it was over, I sometimes wished for the excuse. We took no orders, sniped at the JNA from blown-out windows of our own accord, then in the next moment played cards and had foot races. And though I had learned to expel weapons from my everyday thoughts, speaking of them now, I felt something I wasn't expecting. Longing. As jarring as the guns were to the pale crowd before me, for many of us they were synonymous with youth, coated in the same lacquer of nostalgia that glosses anyone's childhood. But I knew no matter how I twisted my words, I could never explain that I felt more at ease among those rifles than I did in their New York City skyscraper. Instead, I tried for pragmatism, to say something that might at least help someone else. "You should know that your food aid does not reach the people it's supposed to," I said. "In the place where I stayed, there were no peacekeepers, and the Chetniks stole the aid meant for civilians. If you drop the food and leave, you're just feeding your enemy. We had guns, but they had more. Firepower is the only thing that determines who eats." Eventually, I felt the telltale warmth of a person beside me and realized Sharon had returned and was waiting for me to finish. "Thank you for your time," I said. The audience clapped more assuredly now. They were either intrigued by what I'd said or glad it was over. Sharon squeezed my shoulder, then transitioned into her segment on Serbian concentration camps. I looked over at the African boys, whose eyes were permanently reddened from too much rubbing or crying or coke, concealing some unidentified tragedy. I returned to my seat, relieved I had gone first. But when they got to the photos of the mass graves, I slipped out a side door and vomited in a potted plant. I didn't come back for the rest of the presentation, not wanting to see someone I recognized. Chapter 2. I crossed the front grounds of the UN complex, a tundra of concrete and winterized fountains, and passed through the exit gate. Sharon and I were supposed to have lunch after the event, but I figured there was still about an hour left if the other boys were to speak, and I could no longer stomach the sight of the place or the memories it churned within me. I negotiated my way across First Avenue traffic and climbed the steps back toward Tudor Village. I'd have to stay nearby to make a quick return to meet Sharon. More than my debt to her, I was realizing now the chance to talk to someone who'd known me even briefly in Croatia had been the real reason I'd come. Maybe she could tell me something about what happened to the people I'd left behind. The late winter air was still chilly, but at least it eased my nausea. I'd always found solace in Manhattan, felt secure among its buildings and streets crowded with strangers whose lives might be just as jumbled as mine. As far as university went, I'd chosen the city more than the school. Neither of the Americans I'd come to call my parents had gone to college, and I had only vague notions of what I might want to study. So with no other criteria, I recalled Zagreb, its alleyways and trams, the autonomy and mobility that came with the compactness of a city, and set my sights on New York. But now, as I walked down 44th Street, examining this unfamiliar piece of Manhattan, I felt out of place. The street could have belonged to another city entirely, so different in aesthetic and purpose from the West Village, where I spent most of my time. Clean sidewalks, sparsely populated by people in ties and buffed leather shoes. Black cars with drivers and diplomatic license plates idling curbside. I passed a string of UN program offices and the UNICEF building, names that had meant so much hope to me as a child across the ocean, and so little to me now. I stopped in a bodega to buy a roll of breath mints. While digging around in my jacket for change, I saw my phone flashing with a text message from Brian. "Morning, babe. Where'd you go?" I didn't want to lie, so I wrote nothing and stuffed the phone back in my pocket. Brian and I had been dating for a year, but he didn't know anything about who I really was. I'd told him, as I had everyone else at college, that I was born in New Jersey. At first, I was confident in the choice to keep my past life a secret. I could experience college and the city without the old sadness in wait at every turn. For a while, it worked. I made a few friends, met Brian, stayed out too late smoking and drinking and dancing, walking home wide-eyed and enchanted by the city lights. Slowly, in a place uncontaminated by the specter of childhood, I was learning to live a normal life. Then, at the start of my third year, the towers had fallen. I was in an 8 a.m. chemistry class making periodic table jokes with my lab partners when a professor from a neighboring classroom appeared in the doorway. She let herself in. "Hank," she said, "you've got to see this." She searched through Dr. Reed's desk drawers while he looked on, annoyed. She found the remote and aimed it upward with a shaky hand. The television, having been left in video input mode, produced a static growl. She turned to a news channel. The fire was lurid even through the grain of the old set, startling in both intensity and size, but it was when the cameraman zoomed out that the entire class gasped in recognition. Professor Reed flipped the emergency switch to cut power to the gas line, deactivating our experiments, and we circled around the television.
"You are looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there," said the news voiceover. "That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers."
"Oh, God, which tower is that?" said a girl in the back of the lab.
"What kind of pilot was flying that low over New York City?" a boy beside me said. "Fucking idiot."
"My brother works in South Tower," the girl said.
"What if it wasn't an accident?" I said. "What do you mean, not an accident?" said the boy. "What the fuck was it, then?"
Our professor punched the keypad of his cell phone, but whomever he called didn't pick up, and he snapped the phone shut.
"I want you to go back to the dorms," he said. "If you live off campus, find someone you can sit with for a while."
We collected our books, except for the ashen girl, who stayed below the television. "It was the North Tower," I said, pointing to the ticker text. "I'm sure your brother's fine."
"Guys?"
Dr. Reed called as we reached the door. He didn't look up. He was pressing keys on his phone again.
"Take the stairs."
Outside, I tried to get a look downtown, but I couldn't see anything. I wondered where Brian was and felt around in my backpack for my cell phone. My American parents had given it to me for my birthday the month before, but I still wasn't used to carrying it around and was constantly misplacing it. When I found it, the screen revealed several missed calls. I tried to call Brian, then home, but was met each time with a busy signal I'd never heard before, the sound of millions of people simultaneously on the phone. Not knowing what else to do, I ran back to my dorm and found Brian pacing the front hall. I was relieved and a little shocked to find him whole and fine and right in front of me. Instinctively, I realized, I'd been expecting the worst.
"You're okay," I said, trying not to sound too surprised.
Brian kissed me on the forehead, and we went upstairs, where my floormates were already crowded in the common room. We sat staring at the television, watched the strike on the second tower and its collapse a few hours later. The ticker had changed from disaster to attack. Eventually, I got through to my family, an inexplicably whispered call, as if we were afraid speaking too loudly might send something else toppling. "I was fine," I said over and over, trying to placate the woman I'd come to call my mother. And I was fine, I assured myself when I hung up. After all, nothing had happened to me. Brian wanted to stay, but I feigned a research paper and a string of apologies, and reluctantly he returned to his own dorm. I wanted to be alone. Even after everyone had gone to bed, I stayed up watching the towers that were no longer towers, what everyone was now calling Ground Zero. A desire to be close to the wreckage overwhelmed me.
I went out and walked south until I got to the fire engine roadblocks, stood there for a while, awash in emergency light. The air was still thick with the smell of burning plastic and molten steel, dry, itchy breaths filled with plaster particulate. When I returned to the common room, the news was replaying the day's footage, jerky shots of asphalt concealed by a layer of ashes and dead people's paperwork, documents that had been considered important, maybe even classified, just that morning. The coverage returned to real time, a live helicopter shot of the skyline. A cloud of smoke lingered over the spot, tinged orange from the reflection of the city's lights. I tried again to quell the solipsistic thought I'd been evading all day, that trouble would follow me wherever I went. It was now 6 months since the attacks, and the everyday things were returning to normal, first through an attitude of compulsory courage, fear means letting them win, then in a slow reinstating of routines, until we were again wrapped up in the mundane inconveniences of city life. Knocking radiator pipes, subway construction reroutes, and the usual array of vermin. The country was at war, but for most people the war was more an idea than an experience, and I felt something between anger and shame that Americans, that I, could sometimes ignore its impact for days at a time. In Croatia, life in wartime had meant a loss of control, war holding sway over every thought and movement, even while you slept. It did not allow for forgetting. But America's war did not constrain me. It did not cut my water or shrink my food supply. There was no threat of takeover with tanks or foot soldiers or cluster bombs, not here. What war meant in America was so incongruous with what had happened in Croatia, what must have been happening in Afghanistan, that it almost seemed a misuse of the word. My phone rang and startled me, and I answered in a shaky voice. It was Sharon. Anna, where'd you go? I just needed some air. Should I meet you in the lobby? I realized I had wandered farther west than I should have. I jogged back across the avenues and up to the gates of the UN, where a tour group was clogging the entrance portals. I hit redial on Sharon's number, but she appeared through the exit moments later with an armful of file folders and my index cards. I figured you wouldn't be able to get back through that mess, she said. Do you want these? She handed me the index cards. You hungry? I wasn't, but I was eager to get away from the UN and have Sharon to myself. I've got a reservation. We can walk. I trailed behind her back up the stairs, in awe of the ease with which she carried herself in high heels. I still clomped whenever I tried to wear them, and the older I got, the more unlikely it seemed I would ever learn the grace other women had. Each time we passed an expensive-looking restaurant, I held out hope we'd be going someplace more casual, where I wouldn't make an ass of myself. Sharon pecked at her BlackBerry and gestured absently to UN-affiliated properties. The Malaysian consulate, the hotel where all the bigwigs stayed. I looked at them inattentively, but could think only of how I might begin the conversation I'd been suppressing for a decade. The sun broke through a patch of gray, warming my cheeks and sending India's mission building shimmering. At the top, the inset porch was now awash in a spring gold, sun spilling through the latticed skylight and glancing off mirrored cut-ins along the walls. It is a beautiful one, Sharon said, leaning back on her heels. Something futuristic about it, almost. I'd been thinking the opposite, that the russet granite suggested desert, an ancient temple kind of beauty. But I said nothing and followed her across the street. The restaurant looked a little dingy, its awning faded and curtains caked in dust. When we entered, though, I was dismayed to find the place was indeed upscale, if not exactly clean. The tables were sheathed in stodgy white linen even for the lunch hour. I looked down at my sneakers. I'll have the house red, Sharon said to a waiter in a metallic vest. Can I have a Coke, please? The waiter smiled and took my wine glass away with him. The room was lit with patchy spotlights, and I squinted at the menu. There were no prices on anything. I think that went very well, don't you? Said Sharon. I told her I thought so too, but in reality I wasn't so sure. I fiddled with my napkin, folding and unfolding the little cloth rectangle, and asked about her project. She responded with stock lines about busyness and moved her file folders beneath her chair. But enough about that. How's college? And your sister, Rahela? The use of my sister's name, the one no one had called her in years, caught me off guard. We call her Rachel here. And she's well? She's good, yeah. I'm surprised you remembered her. Petar often spoke fondly of your family when we were on duty together, particularly during the period in which you were missing. Speaking of Petar, for all the times the question had lingered in my mind, it was difficult to shape in my mouth. The finality of knowing. Do you... I faltered. The waiter returned with our drinks, and I hoped Sharon, who had not picked up the menu, would tell him to go away. But she ordered a steak salad with mustard dressing, and, unprepared, I ordered the same. When the waiter left, Sharon sipped her wine and looked at me expectantly. What were you saying? Nothing. She paused, but decided to take me at my word. Then tell me more about you. I want to hear all about your new family, your new life. I clenched my teeth at her use of the word. New, like I had traded one family for another in a used car deal. I swallowed the resentment and told her that my family was kind and had taken good care of me. Rahela was healthy now, as if nothing had ever been wrong with her at all. We'd spent most of the last 10 years in a suburb of Philadelphia, where everything was clean and calm. That I had come to New York to get away from that quiet. Sharon nodded along like a woman at church. She meant to be encouraging, I knew, or else she was pleased with herself, but either way it bothered me that my life was something for her to evaluate and take some kind of credit for. Anyway, I said. I looked down at my plate. I wanted to ask you about Petar. Sharon stopped nodding. Do you know what happened to him? The day we left? No, she said. The man I sent, they couldn't find him. Then I was in Germany for a month, and after that Bosnia, out of communication. I was sort of hoping you had... I haven't, I said. I tried. I wrote letters, even asked the people who set up the new embassy, but there was nothing. What about all the other guys in the unit? I think of all of them, of course, but none of them were as close. Petar and I were friends. And after you, I just wanted to know that everything was okay. Petar told me he saved your life. That too. I owe him. Really, it was probably more than once. His unit actually used their guns, and we were carrying ours around like handbags. My face must have betrayed my anxiety, because Sharon said, I'm sorry. Sometimes I just feel like if I don't laugh about it, something really ugly could take root in me. I'm sure you understand. I said I did. You know, in the end, you're my biggest success story. I thought of Sharon's speech, the photos of the grave excavations, all the others, like my parents, who hadn't yet been found. I don't know if success is the word. She smiled faintly. Maybe not. Truth is, I don't think I'll ever get over the things I saw there. She paused. But I shouldn't be putting that on you. I told her it was okay. Petar would be so proud of you. I mumbled a thanks and concentrated on my salad until the waiter mercifully appeared with the check. I reached for my wallet. 20 and studenthood was an interim existence in which I frequently found interacting with real adults awkward, them waving off my offers to split bills as something ridiculous and making me feel even more like a child. Don't even think about it. Are you sure? I said, though in this case I was thankful. My work-study check was sure to take a hit from the priceless menu. Sharon gave me an exaggerated nod as she tipped back the last of her wine.
Outside, the burst of spring had given way to a thin, cold drizzle. Sharon pulled the belt of her trench coat tight as we stood together on the curb. "Do you ever think about going back?" she said. I tried not to think about it at all until you called. I moved to pull my coat closed, too, but the zipper was jammed. Do you? I don't think it's a good idea. For me. She stuck her arm out to hail a cab. Looks like the skies are about to open up. You need a ride somewhere? I shook my head. Anyway, we were going in opposite directions. A taxi pulled to the curb on the other side of the street. Guess I'll take that, she said. We shared a mannered hug, and she ran across the street, still poised in her heels on the slick asphalt. I watched her into the cab, but she was typing something on her BlackBerry and didn't look up again. As I walked to the subway, my mood blackened. Something like anger, but about what I couldn't pinpoint. Frustration, maybe, that I still understood so little. Instead of clarity and insight, adulthood had only brought more confusion. At the next corner, I dumped the index cards in the trash. Chapter 3. The city was crowded and wet and grim, with that air of gray desperation it sometimes took on in March. Lunch had gone long, and I was going to be late for my appointment with Professor Ariel. I tried to gauge whether I had enough time to return to my room to retrieve the book he'd loaned me, but decided against it and headed straight for his office. Reading was one of the only ways in which I allowed myself to think about the continent and country I'd left behind. Though I hadn't told the professor anything about myself, he seemed to know I was not at home in the world, and so he lent me books, Kundera and Conrad and Levi and a host of other displaced persons. I'd read one and return to his office, where he'd wax eloquent about the authors with such intimate detail I was convinced they were all his close friends. I'd just finished The Emigrants, and though most of the week's anxieties had been UN-focused, the book hadn't been much easier on my mind. I'd followed the wandering protagonist, at once forlorn and whimsical, all the while with an uneasy feeling that the professor somehow knew more about me than I cared to reveal. I ran up the stairs to his office and knocked, though the door was half open. The room was small and warmly lit, with shelves covering nearly every surface. Stacks of overflow books lined the floor. Professor Ariel sat at a desk in the center, looking little and frail amid his collection.
"Come in. Sit down," he said in his trembly way. "What did you think of the Sebald?"
I moved some papers from the chair and put them on his desk. Behind him on the wall, a giant poster of Wisława Szymborska, whom he'd also made me read, watched over our meetings like a chain-smoking guardian angel. "It got to me," I said.
"Remarkable prose, isn't it?"
"Yes." It was true, but that wasn't the reason. "Not just that, though. The characters. To come face to face with people who never recover from their traumas. It was
disconcerting."
I nodded.
"And yet, Sebald continually points to the imperfections of memory. Not what we usually think of as the searing of a certain trauma into one's mind. That haunting lucidity. What do you make of it?"
That had been what scared me most. What if my memory of my parents' final moments was all wrong? I felt certain I had kept them fresh and protected inside me. The idea that the whim of the subconscious might corrupt what little I had left of them was too much to accept. "But maybe it's not that way for everyone. Maybe some people do remember," I said.
"Certainly. But that comes with its own problems, no? Consider the character of Ambrose Adelvarth."
"His uncle?"
"Tormented by such clear images of his past."
"He opts for electroshock therapy, to wipe out the thoughts."
"Precisely."
"So what am I supposed... I mean, what are we supposed to take from it?"
Damned if you do.
He smiled a little, then turned to look out the window. He began talking about Sebald's recent death, a car crash of questionable explanation, but I was feeling too rattled to respond.
Anna, you all right? You're looking a bit peaked.
He said my name the Croatian way, not with the long, flat A's most Americans used.
I'm fine. Sorry, I said. Just a little under the weather.
Sebald has that effect on people. I call it the spell of despair.
I tried to protest, not wanting him to think I couldn't manage his assignments, but he turned and stared right at me, and I fell silent.
Where did you say you were from again?
Originally? I had not said. I didn't want to say. But it came out anyway. From Croatia. Zagreb. A strange, weightless feeling came with having spoken the truth. I gripped the side of the chair as if I really was at risk of floating away. Professor Ariel did not seem surprised.
He hummed. I thought so.
What?
I had an inkling. Not Croatia, exactly. Just from somewhere else. Though the Balkans make sense.
But how could you tell?
You have an old soul. I should know. I've got one, too. Also, you read too much.
He winked, and I allowed myself a little smile back.
The good news is your friends will catch up.
He swiveled back toward the corner bookshelf.
Now, for next week, can you handle another Sebald? I've got his latest around somewhere.
Slowly he stood and jimmied the book off the shelf with a skeletal finger.
Here it is. Austerlitz.
Sorry I didn't bring the other one back. I came straight from a meeting.
Never mind. You keep it anyway. I'm sure I have another copy.
He shuffled around his desk and put the book in my lap.
Go on, then.
Thank you, I said. But something else had caught his attention, and he was far away now, running his fingers along the spine of a book as if it were Braille, or the hand of someone he'd long loved. So I closed his heavy office door behind me. I returned to my dorm, glad to find the hallways quiet and my roommate gone. I should call Brian, I thought, but could not bring myself to do it. Now that I'd told Professor Ariel even just a little about me, I felt dangerously open. If I saw Brian, I might tell him, too, and I was not ready to deal with the consequences of my deception. Instead, I filled my oversized skateboarder's backpack, remnant of my high school anti-establishment phase, with homework and Sebald and dirty laundry, and left. At Penn Station, I bought a dollar bag of oversalted popcorn and climbed aboard the first in a series of commuter trains to Pennsylvania. By the time I boarded the commercial jet in Frankfurt, I hadn't slept in 2 days and was afraid of nearly everything. I was frightened by the pressure in my ears at takeoff of catching the sickness of the man who was throwing up into a paper bag across the aisle, of whatever was waiting for me on the other side of the ocean. When we landed, flight attendants took turns reading the airline tag around my neck like I was lost luggage. One grabbed my wrist and dragged me toward customs, where I moved through a series of roped-off queues and signed my name to a form I couldn't read. An announcement over the intercom caught her attention, and she stared at the wall clock and tapped her foot. A man with too many badges rifled through my passport, eyeing my makeshift visa with its crooked staple. Behind him, I watched suitcases wind around a black track. The officer asked me a question that, from what I could understand, was about whether I'd recently been on a farm. I looked at his badges and shook my head. The officer stamped my passport and sent me onward, and the flight attendant said goodbye. At the baggage carousel, I found my suitcase and followed everyone else toward a set of glass doors. The doors looked sealed, with no knobs or handles, but no one else seemed to notice. I thought about yelling out that everyone should be careful, but couldn't think of how to say it in English. As the first people pushed ahead, I narrowed my eyes, anticipating a spray of broken glass. But the doors slid open at the last minute, like magic. On the other side, groups of excited loved ones clustered around the opening. A little boy attached himself to his mother's leg. Two friends hugged and jumped and screamed in one another's ears. Beyond them, men in suits bearing signs with people's names ringed the lobby. I continued through the crowd, head tilted to compensate for the swirling feeling inside me, until I ran right into a man holding a toddler who looked like my sister. The man looked down, and for a moment it was unclear which one of us was more terrified. The woman beside him, who was holding a handwritten sign bearing my name with diacriticals in odd places, shuffled through a handful of paperwork. She was short and tan, and her face was set in a smile.
Rahela?
I peered up at the healthy, curly-haired little girl perched in the crook of the man's arm. She'd grown so much she was almost unrecognizable, except around the eyes, where we had always looked alike.
I thought the airline was supposed to bring you...
Well, the woman found the paper she was looking for.
Dobrodošli o Ameriku, Anna,
she read haltingly from her sheet.
Hvala.
I searched again through my school lessons for any English words that would fit together and make sense. The woman bent down and hugged me.
It's so nice to meet you,
she said. Their names were Jack and Laura, and they said it was okay for me to call them that. But Rahela called them Mommy and Daddy in her high-pitched toddler voice, and for the first few months, I called them nothing at all. I changed trains in Trenton and fell asleep in a saggy leather SEPTA seat. I dreamt of bodies. They were nightmares I'd had years ago when I first arrived in America, dreams in which I'd be cliff diving from the rock ledges in Petar and Marina's fishing village and in a mid-air exchange was no longer headed for the warm Adriatic, but was instead careening toward a pile of bloated corpses. Then, as I was landing, a powerful tingle radiated from my neck to the backs of my knees and jolted me awake. The train pulled into the station, and the conductor yelled, "Last stop!" and I gathered my things. On the platform, I watched the train ready itself for reversal, part of me already wishing I could go back with it. I trudged down the town's main thoroughfare, lined with interconnected strip malls, a two-story pet supply, the Kmart where I worked summers, all the major fast food chains, and vacuum mania. Sometimes I felt guilty that Jack and Laura had moved here for Rahela and me. I wondered if they ever missed their life before us. For years, they too had been city dwellers, their apartment just enough for newlyweds and the baby they couldn't have. Then Rahela arrived, and soon she was rosy-cheeked and growing, toys and clothes brimming from her allocated chest of drawers, annexing the arms of furniture. Of course they knew they'd have to give her back. But with her presence they began to want the things they'd always dismissed as the desires of people older than they were. They bought a cheap piece of land on a hill that was going to become a neighborhood and began to build. When construction started, I was nothing to my American parents but the older sister mentioned in Rahela's Medi Mission fact sheet. Then, before the building was finished, I was there.
"Which bedroom do you want?"
Laura asked me on move-in day. The thought of my own bedroom was an alien concept, and I'd defaulted to silence, thinking I'd misunderstood. In the end, I picked the room with the bigger window, because it reminded me of the balcony in Zagreb. The hill overlooked acres of farmland, and beyond that, forest. When family and friends came to visit the new house, all of them remarked on the beautiful view. But in those first months, I spent each day searching the skyline for a building, craving something dirty or metal to break through the dark green. I never got used to the forest, not after months or years, not even in daytime,
when the sunlight passed through the leaves. I made up excuses to withdraw from neighborhood games of manhunt that ventured too close to its edge. At night, the trees seemed to lean inward, casting shadows on my wall. They were chestnut oaks, Jack said, when I asked